Welcome to the McGuffman. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themcguffman.com, to keep up on whatever podcasts we've done recently. Most recently did The King of Comedy, the Martin Scorsese 1982 film. Before that was Ad Astra. Before that was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And before that was Eighth Grade. So yeah, themcguffman.com. James.
Alex.
Here we are.
We are.
Getting to the bottom of the mystery. What are we talking
about? Yeah, we're talking about Knives Out.
Great.
I know, a movie we've been looking forward to for a long time, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
Lots of people we like, but I guess it's the Rian Johnson name that I think had us on board for a very long time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, since Brick... By the time I was all the way through Brick, the first viewing, I was like, yeah, I'll watch everything this guy makes for the rest of his life. And, I mean, so far, I followed through on that. Yeah, this is a kind of interesting in that this is sort of the movie where we've talked about this a little bit in the past, probably most recently with Dunkirk, that was just like where Christopher Nolan was the name that was sold. This is a bit different than that, but Rian Johnson has crossed over to like a name that is like really big on the marketing now. You know, like on every poster, it says a Rian Johnson whodunit, and he's very heavily involved in the promotional cycle of this movie. Partially because it seems like he might actually like participating in promotional cycles for movies, but it's always interesting to me when a director crosses over into. I don't want to, like, maybe notable celebrity is a little bit too much, but at least celebrity by director standards is really interesting. And of course, he did make a Star Wars in between Looper and this, so that can happen pretty easily in that case. But yeah, it's still interesting because, as I said, a Rian Johnson whodunit is on every poster. That's something he wrote on the script, and apparently his title pages for pretty much every one of his scripts has something like a Rian Johnson noir for Brick or whatever. And now it's become part of the marketing. And I find that like kind of interesting.
Yeah. And
deserved. Like, it's great because he's actually a really good filmmaker.
Yeah. We've talked about everything he's done on this podcast, right?
We didn't do The Last Jedi.
Oh, yeah. Well.
Not because I don't think that movie's worth talking about. I think there's a good conversation to have about it, but it's a frustrating one.
Yeah, I hope someone has a conversation about that Star Wars movie sometime.
I mean, it needs to be talked about.
Yeah, so we've really liked, I mean, we'll just put Last Jedi aside because that's kind of a whole other thing, but and you touched on it, but we've liked what he's done, and it's definitely the Star Wars thing that's catapulted him into a spot where his name is big enough, because the other movies were successful and people liked them, but they weren't huge, right?
Brothers Bloom certainly was not, and Brick never would have had a chance to be huge. I have no recollection of how well Looper did.
It wasn't massive, but speaking of Brick, I mean, this talking about a director becoming more and more successful, this is a much different movie than Brick, but you can kind of see a straight line between the two, and Brick is a movie you can make cheaply and still make it very interesting and very cool, as we felt that movie was.
I think it was $250,000 in the case of Brick.
Okay, so very cheap and very cool. And this is just a harder movie for, you know, a smaller director to make. And he's been open about the fact that it was really Daniel Craig getting on board that kind of got all this to snowball. And this is not an incredibly expensive, action-packed movie, but if you want a big ensemble of good actors and you want the big mansion, that's kind of a part of this movie, and I mean, admittedly a very dumb action scene, but still an action scene.
Hey, those Hyundai rentals aren't cheap.
You know, that's just the kind of movie that you know, is more difficult to make, and it looks like he kind of just cashed in some of his career capital and made something. And judging by the way that it seems that almost everybody is talking about this movie, it was, you know, a successful venture.
Yeah. I mean, I love seeing it with crowds. Specifically, like, the two things I love is how hard everybody laughs every time I've seen the donut hole explanation at the end, the second time Daniel Craig brings up the donut hole. It's so funny. And the way people laugh at it is so charming. And also, as people figure out how much of a comedy it is pretty early on, like, I find that there's sort of like a, wait, is this a comedy sort of vibe in the theater for the first few minutes? And then it really, people start to sort of click in when Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who does the audio on that, whatever the Marta's sister is watching in the kitchen at the very beginning, when he says, we've got the nanny cam footage, that's sort of when a lot of people start to click over. And then you sort of, you can feel the audience being like, okay, I guess this is a comedy, like over the next 5 to 10 minutes. And it's just really fascinating. To experience that with a lot of people simultaneously. And also the movie's good, that helps, you know, like it's just I love watching it, it's very funny, and it's, yeah, it's great.
Yeah, where did people not know this was going to be a comedy?
I don't think people knew it was going to be like maybe 50% of a comedy and 50% of a mystery, you know. That's my feeling. When I feel like people are walking into this movie thinking murder mystery that might have some jokes in it. That's sort of my feel about it.
Right.
And I know that, yeah. I know the trailers don't exactly downplay the comedy aspect in any way, but I just think that's the takeaway from this, that somebody, if somebody sees the trailer or a poster and it's like, oh, I'm going to see that movie, they remember that it's a murder mystery and forget the tone of the trailer, you know?
I think they remember CSI KFC.
Yeah, it's fair. I'm just saying, like, we are different animals than most people who go see this movie. You know?
Yeah.
Because we're horrible people.
Yeah, I was happy to see that it was funny. And I was happy to see that it wasn't too self-referential funny. I mean, I was happy that the jokes are more of a, they come from comedy based on the situation and, you know, funny characters the way that any other, you know, a typical comedy would, instead of being too kind of up its own ass and too focused on making jokes for people who have seen, you know, or read Agatha Christie mysteries or, you know, really liked Clue the movie or something. I'm happy that it really does seem like the comedy is organic here, and his love of those kinds of mysteries stays pretty pure. And there's a couple jokes about the format and things like that, but overall they're just jokes, and they're not trying to be so meta and kind of look down on the genre. It looks like he kind of fully embraces it and plugs a bunch of jokes in, and I'm really happy that was the route that it took.
I will say I feel like this movie was goofier than I anticipated. I also, as with most filmmakers that I like, as much as I like Rian Johnson, I try and avoid trailers if I can. Usually I can't. So I know I saw this trailer and I guess I forgot. But yeah, it was a little goofier than I anticipated, but not in a way that bothered me in any way. Because it's very, very funny. And that's something that I've always felt about Rian Johnson, is he never gets the credit for being as funny as he is, because he's never made an out-and-out comedy, but all of his movies are so funny. But yeah, I remember, like, distinctly about 30 minutes into this movie thinking, like, I was happy for you, because this seemed like a movie that was made for you, you know? Like, it is just, and like, I like it, but this just feels more like a James movie than an Alex movie to me. Just the mixture of a fun mystery game that you tend to like more than me, just games in general, and also the comedy aspect, which is something near and dear to your heart, and a particular like modern version of kind of screwball level comedy, you know. And it just, I don't know, it just felt like a lot of things that I knew you were interested in coming together in a nice 2019 package, you know.
Yeah, yes, that makes sense to me, and I think
it's like
that
we finally get to do the Clue podcast you've been talking about for years, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, I think this is a bit more straightforward than the Clue one, as I was saying. I mean, it does seem more down the middle, and it in a good way, and it seems like it is more concerned with the mystery itself than making, or, you know, kind of having fun at the expense of the mystery. And I mean, there is a really cool, you know, central mystery at the center of this movie, and it's impressive that it's I don't want to say new because I haven't, you know, read all these books and seen all these movies that would kind of fit in this broad category, but really typically we have, you know, we have our murder victim who is often a bad person, and that's why there's so many people who have a motivation to have committed the murder. And then we care about them getting to the bottom of this murder, typically because we like the detective and they're funny, and it's fun to see them, you know, use their intelligence to outwit people and figure out the holes in their alibis or what have you. And this isn't that. You know, we like the victim. We like the murderer, if, you know, while Marta's the, you know, the murderer in a way, and, you know, that gets a bit muddy by the end. But, you know, we like her, and we're watching this investigation, and we also do like the detective, but we don't want him to kind of get to the bottom of it because we like Marta so much. We dislike all the suspects because the way that they treat the murderer, which is, you know, this weird way to put it all on its head. And I think that's one of the most impressive feats of this movie, is that it does this thing that, again, I can't say it's entirely new, but it's certainly something we're unfamiliar with. And it certainly keeps us, I find it keeps us really engaged. And I think another really great feature of this movie is that it's just so propulsive. Like, you never really get bogged down, and it is over 2 hours, which, I mean, just barely, I guess. But between the comedy, between it being an interesting mystery, and, as I said, a different form of the mystery, I think it just really plugs along and really just takes you for a ride. And I think that is why people are responding so well to it.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. And the other thing that I'll throw it, like, there's a lot of, and this is something that's present throughout a lot of Rian Johnson's career, of toying with genre. Like, he has actively talked about, he likes making genre movies because it gives you this sandbox to play with, and then people have certain expectations, and then you get to subvert them. And like you're saying about Harlan being a character who is likable, because, I mean, he's played by Christopher Plummer. It's harder to make Christopher Plummer play an unlikable character, you know? And and there's very good reason why he would be a likable human, as they establish his character throughout the movie. The other thing that I really enjoyed about this movie is that whodunits are typically period pieces, and this is 2019 with an exclamation mark. And and that's the other thing that I really enjoyed. And I guess tying this into it is, it's worth noting now, the it seems like such a small thing, but it's one of my favorite moments in the movie when Benoit is talking to Marta about Gravity's Rainbow, and he's describing how he loves the term Gravity's Rainbow. It's based on a book. Oh, Marta's like, yeah, I know, I haven't read it. And Benoit's response is, I haven't either, nobody has. And then he just continues talking about the term. It's just, it's so cool to see, like, one, hilarious, like, incredibly funny, because nobody's read Gravity's Rainbow. Two, it's just funny or interesting to see the person that we've been given in this movie as the know-it-all detective immediately being like, oh no, I haven't read it, I'm just using this term that I like from it. And I think that's so cool, because in every other mystery movie ever, it's like, oh, you haven't read it? I obviously have, and let me explain it to you. And I think that's such a, like, quick little moment that I think really sums up everything that I love about this movie, is that it knows what movies came before it, but it's wanting to be its own thing. And I think that also makes Benoit much more likable character to me, just that one moment, you know? Because it just makes him seem human, as opposed to, like, the sleuth characters, admittedly not, I've seen plenty of whodunits, but certainly not at an obsessive level. He just seems more human because of something like that, as opposed to just being like Sherlock Holmes, basically, who just always has the answer no matter what.
Yeah, and I think that there's kind of two stock detective characters. It's the one that you're sort of describing. It's the very cool one who's read everything and knows everything, and just their brain is just this well of information, and you know, they never make a mistake. Or we have the Inspector Clouseau kind of goofball who just manages to pull it out at the end. And he's not that. It's funny reading people talk about, you know, the ridiculous detective at the middle of this movie. Yeah. And he just has an accent, like,
yeah,
it's not that I mean, you know, he it's a bit of a caricature, I understand, he does some goofy things, but I really think if he just didn't have that accent, people would not think that he's, you know, just this crazy cartoon character. And I think it's really funny because a lot of these same people are saying, you know, the way they treat Marta is horrible and they can't remember what country she's even from. And yeah. I don't know, it just kind of rings like, oh, he has a Southern accent, so he must be Foghorn Leghorn now. Yeah. That doesn't quite add up to me, but whatever.
Well, it's the accent is basically pointing the flashlight on the goofy things that he's saying. Whereas when someone like Ransom says that's stupid with two O's, which is a very like goofy thing to say because he just sounds like normal Chris Evans. It's only one stage of goofiness, whereas Daniel Craig is already operating at a level of one stage of goofiness. So when he says something goofy or sings a Sondheim song in the car, it's just like it brings it up a level, and that's why it's more noticeable.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I do want to get back to what you're saying about the kind of period piece that this movie isn't. And you know, you knew from the commercials that this was modern, like CSI KFC and all these things. You know, you could tell it was going to be set, you know, in a relatively modern time, but I didn't know how much that was going to come through. You know, sometimes you see a movie like this and it's kind of a bottle movie and they can spend this whole time in a house from the 1800s and you can really, you know, fall into that time period. You know, if there's not a ton of technology involved, if you're not constantly exposed to the outside world, the time can sort of get stuck in whatever visual aesthetic that you're placed in. Mm-hmm. And this movie doesn't do that. And I think right away when they show the My Coffee, My House, My Rules mug in this big mansion. And, you know, it's this kind of goofy, cheap little mug that's obviously modern. It doesn't fit in with the aesthetics of the house that they're in. I really love that put us in a modern time. Mm-hmm. There's obviously things that are 2019 and, you know, say something about modern politics or society. I'm happy that the movie didn't spend, I don't think it spends a lot of time on that. I think it definitely places us in a very recent era, but that doesn't, when I saw the movie, it just didn't seem like that's what this movie was preoccupied with being. And my suspicions were confirmed listening to Ryan Johnson talk about this movie and that he's been wanting to make it for 10 years. And he just kind of felt like he couldn't not mention these things, you know, not out of some, obligation as an artist or whatever to address these things, but just that in writing dialogue and to try to communicate these characters that are, you know, modern characters, some of these things would pop up. So I think that the balance between this as a kind of old school whodunit and still a modern comedy is impressive. And I think that the tightrope walk of this being a modern and still old school in that respect is another feat of this movie that I think is pretty hard to stick, and they do it very well.
For sure. One thing I will note about the mug that you mentioned, I love that, like, I love that Harlan has a mug that is his mug, like, that he drinks from, that this is just the mug I drink out of. As somebody who has a favorite mug, like, I can respect that. I don't know, that's a really nice touch, and when you see him drinking from it later when he's talking to Marta, and you just know that that's his everyday, it just drives home that that's his everyday mug. And I really enjoy that. What you're saying about 2019 and the moments of modernity, turns out rich people will always be shitty, you know, and you can just sort of, it doesn't matter when you make the movie, you just have to change a few of the words. And actually the first thing I thought about, even before like sort of Trump's America, as most people tend to be gravitating to, is more the financial crisis of, I guess, 11 years ago now. And just because they're all asking for money from, like, they all need money from this, you know, the patriarch at the top of the family. At one point, Benoit even says, you just came here to be bailed out. And and it's just, I think it's worth noting that, I feel like 10 years from now, we could easily point to whatever thing rich people are being the worst about. And you could have remade Knives Out just swapping in some of the different nouns, you know? And I just thought that was worth pointing out, if not super important to the movie.
No, it definitely is. And speaks to the fact that this is something he's wanted to do for a while, and that these things just I can imagine when putting these things together, those are the kind of pieces that are floating around in your head during the entire creative process, and that, you know, the 2008 banking crisis that you're talking about just would have been something that was in his head when he started this thing.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I guess we'll save a bit more discussion for the ending but the way that the mug comes around is wonderful, and I think that that's something that's important to a murder mystery, that when the ending is so important, that to have it come full circle like that is wonderful. But we'll talk about the ending later.
Let's end with the ending.
Yeah,
and we're so bad at not doing that. Let's really make a point to try and do that.
Yeah, and I think that it's Fran who fills his coffee mug at the beginning, who ends up finding him dead on the up in his little attic room there, and bringing him the mug. And but before his death, and this movie jumps around because we have him. We go to the last night of his life, that 85th birthday there. During the interviews, which, again, I think just structurally, the way that this movie rolls out its characters at the interviews and the way that we learn about them while they're explaining what they were doing at the party, I think is, again, just really masterful, the way that this movie just totally chugs along and never really get inundated with exposition, where it's just bouncing between exposition and understanding characters and comedy all at the same time. Like, there's just this way that this movie propels that way that I think is what is so enjoyable to people, even if they can't put their finger on it.
Yes, I agree, especially at the beginning, that, you know, where we're getting so many of those interviews in close together. A lot of them are intercut, and we're getting a lot of character introduction, and basically the backstory that we need to know for the rest of the mystery. And I was listening to Ryan Johnson talking about writing that, and how even up to the shooting script, like every time he would get somebody to read the script and give him feedback on it, everybody said, man, that first 30 pages, it's pretty tough. I don't know. You got to rewrite that. And, for a while he was doing that. And then even the last shooting script, he found he got that same note from people. And he says at some point, he was just like, no, this is right. And just having that level of confidence, like I understand what he means. And I believe him to be correct, because I really enjoy that sequence. But I know how you can, you could be reading that and be like, nah, I don't know, not for me. But the person who knows how all of these pieces are going to come together, who knows how it's going to be shot, who knows how it's going to be cut, I think that that's a really good, that's one of the things that I love so much about filmmaking, is just this leap of faith where it's like, no, I know you don't get this, but I know that I'm right. And when you are right, and not like to be a dick, you know,
yeah,
just to have that confidence and that knowledge of the craft and just be like, no, this will work. And, you know, I'm sure that happens at a lot of points in every time somebody's making a feature film, and you just have to like believe that you are right and then hope that you are, you know? And I just thought that was really interesting. Because, yeah, I could imagine reading that. Actually, I did read that part of the script and be like, yeah, okay, I can see how people would be, like, concerned that he's harpooning his movie before it even really starts.
Yeah, no, I think that they just accomplished so much there. And then, you kind of get, okay, this is the mystery. These are everybody's alibis. These are everybody's motivations, why they could kill him. But we just know so much about who these people are, and it's set up. And it just, as I said, just keeps going from there. And most of this movie is Marta playing defense. You know, she's first trying to sabotage the investigation that she knows she's at the center of, or, you know, as we said, that kind of gets muddied by the end. But
so she's the donut hole at the donut's hole? Is that
I can't track that. and then eventually, you know, she's... But, sorry.
It's all right. I made you laugh too, right?
She's fighting off the family eventually, or, you know, Ransom in particular. And we don't get to see a ton of her as she exists and, you know, the order before all this chaos. It's really just her playing Go with Harlan. And, you know, you just get to see how fun and sweet their friendship is. And it's really not a lot, but, yeah. I mean, it also just helps that she's a pretty lady, so you kind of take her side, and that everyone's just being absolutely horrible to her, but yeah. You manage to get you manage to get on board with this protagonist who is, to our understanding, you know, a careless accidental murderer at this point. And it's just interesting that we get on board with her so quickly. And this takes a bit of a suspension of disbelief, but the way that Harlan is just purely in mystery writer mode once he realizes that he has like 5 minutes to live and is just coming up with her story and her alibi and how she can get away with it. That's another thing that I haven't seen, just the way that she has to do this thing to escape this murder that she accidentally committed. You know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, we finally have a movie for adults that's not IP and it's doing well. That's great.
We have like 40 of those in theaters right now. You know, I guess they're not all doing great. But
I know. I also heard the rundown of the movies that have come out this year. Like, we got a Tarantino movie and all these things. No, but anyway, just the way that this is providing something that is new. And what is, it's not even just that it's an old genre, but it's a genre that is, it's even plays older than it is. You know, the ones from the 20s are kind of planted in the 1800s, and the ones from the 80s are planted in the 20s and 30s. It's always kind of this backwards looking genre. So for it to feel fresh and for him to do something that is not something that we're super already, you know, run down on, I think is very fun and very impressive.
Yeah, no, I concur. I agree with you. Do you have any like particular performances that you really gravitated to in this movie?
I don't know. I think they're all fun. And I think I'm happy that Daniel Craig's isn't bigger. As I said, like
he's
that
like right at the line of how big you can be without ruining
and again,
the movie.
He'll overstep it once in a while and whatever, that's fine. It's a numbers game. But yeah, I think he's kind of right on the edge of it, and it's still quite good. And the movie wants him to be that goofy, so it's not like he's just going nuts with the words. No, I don't know. I think it's just an ensemble cast of very talented actors who do their jobs very well.
Yeah, no, I agree. Everybody is fantastic, and which is unsurprising given the pedigree of the cast. And it was nice to see Chris Evans as I think his name was Jake Wilder in Not Another Teen Movie, but it was nice to see him like bring that sort of vibe back because he's so good at it. And you know, he's been in Marvel jail for so long that I really like Chris Evans as an actor in the right sort of thing. Like, can't really do like full on drama, but something that allows him to be comedic and, I don't know, just be a charming human. I think he's really good at that. And, it's always nice to see that,
but is he charming here? He's
charming really because you know, he's Chris Evans, you know, like he just has that air about him, right? He's charming in the way that, so he's charming in the way that he's an asshole, but he's funny. You know, like that's
that
sort
charming?
Of it. Yes.
Okay. Well, that bodes well for me then, I guess.
I didn't want to be the one to say that's your place in life. But...
No, it is.
See, I'm just an asshole. At least you're funny.
It has been something that I've been thinking about because, I've heard people say that they do like him at this, and I certainly like what he's doing here. I don't know if it's how much of it is people just are happy he's out of Marvel jail, as you said. How much of it is that he's just a handsome person that he's win so many people over that way. And he kind of has a balancing act too, because we have to dislike him as this kind of trust fund ingrate who's mean to his very sweet grandfather pretty early on in the movie and is a reasonable suspect in his murder. So, you know, that's not a good look. But then we have to kind of get back on his side when during his sort of brief alliance with Marta. And then we swing back the other way. So it is a bit of a balancing act there as well.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Did you have a favorite kind of detective murder mystery thriller little trick in this?
Honestly, no. I saw that, like, you posed me that question via email, and my answer is just no, because I guess I'm just not, So I read a lot of mystery books as a kid, and then just for whatever reason, just stopped entirely. And so I don't have one. The thing that that gave me the biggest reaction was the Marta coming through the trick window with the painting of somebody coming through a window on it. That's so great to me. But that's not really the trick side of it. That's more the comedy side of it. So yeah. I suppose I was happy to see Invisible Ink become a part of the movie. That was nice.
Yeah, that's very kids murder mystery book. Yeah. Kids mystery book.
Unrelated to, yeah, exactly. Because Encyclopedia Brown did that in every book, and that's my touchstone for sleuthing.
Also, I feel like you stopped reading mysteries when you decided you knew everything already.
Yeah, at age eight, like all people do. Once I read Gravity's Rainbow at age eight. it was just that. What about you?
Yeah, this is more of my ballywick than yours, but
yeah, just like the use of the word ballywick.
It's inspired by Benoit. I think it's the kind of passing on of the blackmailing, the way that once Ransom was involved as the suspect and was known what he had done by Fran, the way he kind of eliminates himself from that blackmailing situation and makes Marta become the victim. Again, that's something that just the way that I really liked that it was new, that we were following the murderer and, you know, watching her foil / help this investigation and try to steer at different places in the way that that felt new to me. That use of the blackmail, I think, was something that I wouldn't have seen coming. I couldn't remember seeing it anywhere else. It's, you know, it's a bit complicated, but it's, I think this movie, like most things, manages to communicate its even most difficult plot points very well. And, you know, it leads to one of the scenes of real mystery in this movie, because as I said, when you know the murderer, or you believe you know the murderer so early on, it's tough to make a mystery still compelling and to have the audience still actively seeking out more information that they're being given. And I think that part of the plot does that well. And it gives us those scenes with Fran and the abandoned laundromat, I guess. A scene with some real danger to it, and you don't know who it is, and you don't know if Marta's going to be okay, and it's a scene, it's not wall-to-wall without comedy, because I don't know if there's 3 minutes of this movie that are without comedy entirely.
Yeah, that's the part where they cut back to Daniel Craig in the car singing Stephen Sondheim, so it is not without comedy.
Yeah, exactly. But it is, you know, we get a dangerous music with an augmented chord, which is a music thing that is scary and suspenseful. That gives us kind of some of the weight of this movie, that because it is funny and heavy, you do need that weight, and I think that provides it. And I think it's an important scene to really keep this grounded and, as I said, not just too goofy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's sort of that's one of the things that I think really, another thing that modernizes the movie, or maybe not modernizes, but at least plays with the whodunit aspect, is it sort of becomes that a suspense movie for 20 minutes. You know, the mystery still matters, but it's more physical, like the just the process that's being run through when Marta's going to see the it's not a hospital, wherever the blood work is, that has been burnt down, and then the dumbest car chase ever, and then the laundromat sequence. Like, all of that is more of something that you would see in a suspense movie, as opposed to the mystery still being solved inside of the house. You know, you get the whodunit bookends for sure, which is the main portion of the movie, but in the middle you get that portion where people are just not in the house, they're not in the Thrombey mansion,
yeah,
or a smaller number of your people are not in the house, we don't really know where the other people are, it doesn't matter, but just that main core of people that really matter to the story by that point are off doing various adventures, you know, and
cheating on their wife and
yeah, all trying to come back to the same place, or all eventually going to come back to the same place to solve the crime, or solve the mystery together. But yeah, it's another thing that, one, keeps the level of tension up, because that's the most suspenseful portion of the movie, and two, just again differs from the genre that you anticipate when you're walking in.
Yeah, I mean, someone's got to be out there running flam, so.
Yeah, of course.
You can't just be hanging out at the mansion all the time. God. No, and I think part of
you mentioned Toni Collette. Toni Collette is the performance. Also, this movie's so good that Toni Collette said, sure, I'll be in it for 8 minutes. Like, that's like how much people wanted to be in this movie. I think that just had to be noted, but continue.
Yeah, and she gets a good trailer line. What was I saying? Sorry?
I don't know. I heard Toni Collette, I blacked out.
I know what it was. I think that, honestly, in this, don't get mad, anybody, but when I did leave this movie, I kind of wished it was a little bit funnier. And I know I've been saying that it is funny, and that's one of the things that I do like about it. And everyone seems to say, oh, this was really funny.
This movie's so funny.
I know. I might see it again and just be like, okay, I was very stupid for ever saying that.
Yeah.
And to that point, I wonder that, you know, I like the kind of comedy it is. I didn't want it to be zanier and more self-reflective, as I said. You know, I didn't need 20 James Bond jokes because Daniel Craig's in it. I didn't need a bunch of Easter eggs about career, like people's careers or Agatha Christie or whatever. Mm-hmm. I wished it was funnier. And then as we've been having this discussion, as I've been preparing for this, I wonder that if it was any funnier or spent any more time trying to make jokes and not, as I said, kind of give that weight to this movie, mm-hmm. not give the gravity to this rainbow. I think I'm using that correctly.
Yeah, definitely.
not that. That it would have got away from that stuff we were just talking about, that heaviness and caring about these characters and the heart of this movie, and it would have just felt more like a romp. And I think that it's easy to say, oh, that should have just been funnier, and kind of overlook what you know, the way that this movie allocates its resources and having you care about things, because it's kind of the problem with, you know, the last third of a comedy movie, that, you know, it's, that's always seems to be the least funny part because they have to tie everything together, and that's a common complaint. But we know that you have to do that, or if it's just 90 minutes of people fucking around, mm-hmm. you don't care. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to trust Rian Johnson as a better filmmaker than I am. that he did this successfully. And in that scene, you know, to speak to the things that are being, you know, moved forward, that scene is, we have Marta save Fran's life when it kind of would have just been easier to run away. You know, now she's around a second dead body in mm-hmm. X number of days. And she just stays because she's a good person and she sees an opportunity to save someone's life, even though it's extremely incriminating for her. And, you know, that's what this movie is. They even say it when she plays Go and Harlan wonders why she keeps winning. And she says, you know, you're trying to win, I'm just trying to make a pretty picture. Like, everybody else in this movie is looking after themselves and is trying to steal money or, you know, trying to cheat on their wife. And, you know, there's all these people just looking out for themselves. Well, what she does is act like a good person all the time, and it works out. You know, yeah. Like, she kills somebody at the start of this movie, but it's because she was such a good nurse that she knows what the medications look like without reading the label. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, that kind of bounces around when the labels are switched and all these things, but she's a really good nurse and she's a good person, and it works out for her. That's how she gets into the will. That's how she saves, you know, that's why she has this attempt to save Fran's life. She does all these things the right way, and that's why, you know, she ends up with the mug and everybody else is on the ground, right?
Yeah, for sure. And just to go back to what you were saying about it sort of towing the line between comedy and mystery, I think this whole movie is just like Rian Johnson walking on a tightrope, you know, Rian Johnson and his yeah. crew. And it's it's so precise, and so, this is such a difficult movie to pull off, but it looks not difficult at all because of how well they pulled it off. Like, just the, if you're just looking at the intro sequence that we talked about, or not really the intro sequence, but the first interview sequence where we're getting all these characters, just look at how many different angles are shot of those different characters just sitting in the same place, where it would have been so easy to just do the same shot again and again and again. But there's so much, so many changes there. They're not flashy changes. They're just angle changes. And they tend to correspond with something that the subject is saying that would lead to sort of a change of perspective. And it's just, it's really masterful. And it's not as exciting as, say, some of the, like, big dolly shots in Looper or Brick are. But it's still just somebody who is... just so masterful, and I think that runs entirely through this movie. And you still get those flashes of sort of more aggressive Rian Johnson filmmaking later, but between the interview sequence and the way that they find ways to move the camera within the house, where there are shots linking maybe three characters within one dolly move or a dolly move in a pan, it's really great. And I don't think necessarily for this shot means this and it tells me this about Marta. It's more just like linking characters together in a space. That tends to be the big idea behind most of the camera moves inside of the house. And it's just really interesting to see somebody who I've been interested in for 13 years sort of like mature in that way. Whereas it feels like a lot of the camera moves that they could afford in Brick are flashy just to be flashy because we need something flashy to keep people interested. Whereas watching this movie again, every time the camera moves, I'm just like, okay, that works because of that. And it's just, it's really cool to see. And obviously I don't have a lot of good examples because I saw this movie in a theater, sans Notebook, but yeah, it's just, it's really interesting to see in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another impressive thing that he does is there's no unreliable narrators. Mm. You know, I think that a lot of these movies, people give their alibi and it's their version of it. And that sequence you were just talking about of all those interviews that we get pretty early, that seems like the scene where everybody just tells their version of the story. And we're going to spend the next, I guess, hour at that point trying to parse which one of them is honest or where the lies are. Mm-hmm. And this movie puts it all out there. Like it's all straightforward. It gives you everybody's exact history, what they did that night. And I think that's super impressive, and it's that's really hard to do, is to tell an interesting mystery and to have everything that I think everything that's ever shown on the screen actually takes place. You know, I can't think of what that exception is.
There are two different shots of the cake being given to Harlan, one with Jamie Lee Curtis and Don Johnson next to him, and then another with Michael Shannon and his family next to him. It's sort of yeah, that's the one like Rashomon moment in this movie that I can recall. But even that's so small, you know, it's just like, we're the closest to him. We're the closest to him. That's
yes,
it.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'll give you that for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, I agree that's something I haven't thought about, the idea of there not really being, an unreliable narrator. And that's interesting to me for sure.
Yeah. And as the way that I like that this is a new kind of mystery, That's a new way to do the mystery, is to just be extremely honest. And I think that's such a hard thing to do on screen, is to have the story of everybody's, you know, all these people have different motivations and have reasons to make people believe certain things. But we're, as a viewer, we're never kind of roped into their world. We live in the real world.
Yeah, no, I agree. What was I going to say? Oh, one thing I really loved, this is just the tiniest little thing, but Marta having a cracked phone. Like, I think that's such a a small thing that really normalizes her as far as like being a regular person. I think that's the smallest possible way that you could do it. And just so many shots of it. There's never somebody like, oh, you've got a cracked phone screen. You know, like, it's just, this is my phone. This is what I use day to day. I love that so much.
This is my car.
Yeah, my car, or sorry, my Hyundai, my rules.
this is my cup full of vomit that I keep in the cup holder in my Hyundai.
Yeah, also shout outs to her for having a big gulp cup in her car. That also made me really, really identify with her. Sorry, not for having a car, for having a big gulp cup sitting around. There are a couple more moments of filmmaking that I do want to point out. There's when she leaves the when she leaves the will reading, we get sort of this one very brief handheld sequence as she's going to get to her car, and the whole family's following her and trying to talk to her simultaneously.
Yes. And, oh, I meant to mention that. Yeah.
Yeah. The shot of her leaving the house, it sort of, it still looks like it's a tripod or static jib, whatever you want to call it, sort of shot. But then the camera sort of like rises up as if it's like, okay, we see Marta. This is what we follow, and walks towards her and follows her to the car. And there are cuts in the sequence, but it's the only portion that I noticed that's shot handheld. And then we get that transition as the camera sort of goes down to follow her into the car. You get a transition back to a more static camera. And it's just another small thing. It's not too flashy. I suppose by the standards of this movie, it's pretty flashy, but it's just cool. Like as she's so confused, it's the camera just becomes shakier and less assured, I suppose. It's a less assured camera, and it's just nice to point
out. It's not super flashy, as you said, but it does what you were mentioning about this movie. When it chooses to be flashy, it does so for reasons of character motivation, and to me that transition from, you know, this the static shot to something handheld is that everyone could be nice to Marta while it suits them, you know. It's as soon as not being 100% nice to Marta means you're not going to get the money that you thought you were going to get, then everything's out the window, right? Like, you can be polite and, you know, have this wealthy life of you know, having everything, so you can be nice to everybody, but because you've never had to fight for anything. But as soon as something comes up, it's not as easy to be as solidly placed like that camera is. And it really conveys that sense of stress that everybody's under, you know, the sense of danger and confusion that Marta finds herself in. I meant to mention that because I do think that was something that stands out, and I don't notice that stuff as quickly as you do, but I thought just because it does communicate so much silently, it was just a very wise choice.
Yeah, for sure. And we've talked about how using one shot or one sequence of handheld in a movie is that's a David Fincher staple, and it's interesting to see Rian Johnson do that as well. I don't know that if he's done it in the past or not, but it's cool in this movie. A couple other things that I wanted to point out are just like, I do have a couple more technical things that I wanted to discuss, if you're cool with it. We'll keep on the cinematography thing. So I'll try and make this as brief as possible. Steve Yedlin, Rian Johnson's cinematographer, he has a really interesting website where he's just constantly trying to shut down myths about cameras and how, like, K's don't matter. The tool matters more than anything. And I find it really interesting to follow, despite the fact that a lot of his blog posts are so scientific about how the image actually works and color vectors and whatnot, that I can't even follow what he's saying. It's like Gravity's Rainbow, basically. But it's really worth noting that Rian Johnson, throughout his career, this is the first movie that he hasn't shot on film. And Steve Yedlin, for many years of following his blog, has just been like, it doesn't matter if it's film or digital, you can make digital look like film. It just matters that the movie looks right. And it's really cool to me that this movie was shot on an Alexa Mini primarily, which is a camera that, like, isn't cheap, but is also an accessible camera, all things considered. When you're comparing it with like other movie cameras, like, there is an Alexa Mini in my office. I will be shooting with it on Tuesday. You know, it will not look as good as Knives Out, I can assure you. But it's so cool to see him, Yedlin specifically, be able to do all of this talking about how for years, like, it doesn't matter what the tool is, it matters how you use it. And I do think this movie looks fantastic. And I would believe a version of me seeing this movie not realizing it's not film. I think I knew before I saw the movie, but it's just, it has a really interesting look to it, a really classical look, but doesn't necessarily look like film specifically. And I just thought it was really cool. And I think his work on the day for night shots is really worth pointing out. When you see the house exteriors at night, what they did was shoot the the majority of the shot they shot during the day, and then would green screen in the portions of the porch that had lights. And you can, he's posted screenshots of this on his Twitter, and it's really interesting to check out. And that's that shot where Marta is walking through the trees at night, and she sees the dogs. That's a really beautiful shot, and that's almost certainly day for night. And same with Chris Evans' car driving away, or Ransom's car driving away. Like, that stuff is all really cool and really interesting visually. And yeah, I just really like the look of this movie. And the one thing that I think is so funny about this movie that is so fucking nerdy is, according to Steve Yedlin, they shot one shot of this movie on 35mm. And the only thing, the only explanation I can come up for with it is that they wanted to put like a mystery for the fucking nerds into this movie. And it sounds like something that Rian Johnson would be into. And I just think that's such a funny idea. And I have a guess for what shot it is. I have no idea if I'm right. I have no idea why else they would have done it. But
her cracked phone screen.
No. It's the sequence towards the end when Marta and Benoit are talking for the last time. The shot of Marta is still just shot like everything else, as is the two shot. But I think the close-up on Daniel Craig, it would be the film shot. That's the only guess I have. And I know, I don't think it matters at all. I don't know why they did it other than to just fuck with people like me. And it's just so funny. Like, that's such a good power move on your viewers.
You know? No, I approve of this.
So, and like, neither of them have talked about why they did one shot on film. So at least that I could find, I would so like to know. You know, that's the real mystery of this movie to me.
I love that. That's so perfect for this movie of all movies.
Yeah, exactly. It's a game inside the game.
It's a donut hole inside the donut
exactly.
hole.
Exactly. But yeah, and there are just a couple other moments of editing that are worth pointing out. When Michael Shannon, who's Walt, is that his name? He's sort of accosting Marta.
We haven't mentioned Michael Shannon yet.
Yeah.
That's how stacked this movie is.
Yeah. When he's accosting Marta in the back hallway of her apartment, the editing on that sequence is really cool and really reflects how Marta's feeling. Like, it's just a conversation, and then she realizes she's being threatened. And you get these close-ups of his cane, his hand on the cane hitting the ground sort of percussively, almost like it's a threatening drum. That's really great. And then, of course, when Ransom decides he's going to, in for a penny, in for a pound, he's going to try and kill Marta, that whole sequence is like so incredible. And that's where it's like, everybody shut up, I'm being flashy for a minute and a half. And then it still ends with a great joke. You know, it ties back into the movie, and I love it.
Yeah, and that Michael Shannon scene, that is, as you said, a very good one, of a good scene of editing, and brings that threat, as you said, but brings the danger and the emotion to this movie, which it kind of just has to kind of lace through to make it heavy. And we know Michael Shannon plays good threatening, and it kind of sneaks up on you out of nowhere. But by the end of it, as you said, like, it really is very frightening as he communicates more and more clearly, you know, what his intentions are, what his what threat he's making.
Yeah, for sure. And I also really like the score in this movie. And Nathan Johnson has scored all of Rian Johnson's non-Star Wars films. And I always like them. And I wish he composed for more filmmakers, because I think he's really, really good. And the one thing that seems to be running through this movie, according to him, is that there's a lot of bent or wrong notes, to use his words. Like, there's something wrong buried in the family. And I just thought that was a cool thing. Also, his piano themes in every one of Rian Johnson's movies are so good. And this one is no exception.
Yeah. And the music is fun. I think does that thing we've been speaking about of it. Walking that line of sounding kind of sounding old and bringing up things that you know, come with this genre, but the use of those bent and wrong notes is, you know, very much a more modern music approach to it. And I think that, again, is kind of seamlessly combining those two themes.
Yeah, for sure. And sort of transitioning to the ending, first, I guess the question I have is, what do you make of Nana in this movie in general?
I don't know. I have thought about it, and I don't think much. I don't think that there's, I don't know that there's a lot in there. I think that she kind of, you get a laugh or two out of her kind of looking through the window.
Oh, I think or five.
And I think it's kind of, it again, does what this movie does so well. It, it gives you a laugh, but then also is one more thing to worry about, one more thing that one more loose end in that Marta has to worry about that she's been witnessed, and you think that that's kind of the function of her, and then we learn that she has her function as kind of this plot point for having seen Ransom sneak out or in or out of the house at a different time.
Mm-hmm. I just sort of, I think it's interesting that, well, one, another great joke about her is, and how old is Nana? No one knows. That's one of the biggest laughs I got in the whole movie. Like the idea of having your grandma in your life for the entirety of your life and not knowing how old she is so funny.
It's someone's birthday for a large portion. Yeah, like it's somebody else's 85th birthday.
It's her son's 85th birthday. Yeah.
But I mean, this her Nana's age, like Gravity's Rainbow, is just an unknowable in the universe.
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of like I think that. Since she never really does the Silent Bob thing where she like has this big monologue, which I probably would have walked out, and I never felt like we were in danger of getting that because Rian Johnson's not an idiot. But you
always want more Silent Bob in your filmmaking, I know.
No, Silent Bob walks in the last scene and just explains everything. While Jay's smoking weed on the porch with the daughter. Well, we've ruined another movie on this podcast, but I think just that she's kind of just always there, and she's sort of this set of eyes that watches everything that happens in the house. And since so much of this movie, or so much of us caring about Marta is predicated on her just being a good person when nobody's watching, I think I think Nana is there to be the set of eyes when you kind of think that nobody's watching you. And it's just sort of this reminder to, if you're just a good person, then maybe things will work out. Or if you're being a bad person, somebody will see it, or something bad will come of it. You know, like Don Johnson will get punched in the eye towards the end of the movie. His eye makeup in the last shot is so funny to me. I just think that really ties into Marta in general. Like, it's just the idea of this movie is if you're a good person, it's going to work out. You know, if you're a good person and you work hard, it will work out. And that's such a such an optimistic perspective on a situation like this, but not uncommon throughout, I think, Rian Johnson's career.
Hmm. Yes. Nana Karma will always be there.
Yes. Nana Karma is always there. She might be here now. No one knows. the thing we talked a little bit about the ending, it's relatively simple, but it just really works. And the music cue, the Rolling Stones music cue that starts as they're starting to sum things up, which begins as Marta's asking Benoit, like, should I help them? After he's just said, you're a good person, all of these things. You know, I think that the way that the movie sort of gets summed up is so good. And they spend so much time talking about, or the family spends so much time talking about how they've worked for this money, and that's not true at all, with the exception of maybe Harlan. Just comparing the opening of Marta walking up to the house to see the family, and then at the end, the family all being in the place that she started walking from, you know, to get into the house. They're all just staring up at her on drinking her mug on the balcony. The one thing that I think is really worth noting is that at the beginning of this movie, Harlan has his coffee brought up to him by another person, and Marta is willing to do the work for herself. She brings the coffee up the stairs by herself. You know, she's like, my coffee, my rules, I'll carry it, please. And I think that's another really small thing that really drives home why we're supposed to care about Marta, is that she doesn't need somebody to bring her coffee. You don't suspect that now that she's got this money, she's going to hire, quote unquote, the help. I can strongly appreciate that as somebody who wants to make my own coffee every day for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it's, oh man, there's a lot. So that Stone song is a very famous Stone song, and somehow underrated, somehow, in my opinion. Like, yeah. I think it's just a deeply good song on its own. It seems like a really weird choice for this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, just talking about what we've been talking about, this, because it's not super modern, but it's not old enough to kind of line up with some of the other things in this movie, which, you know, are decades before this song would have been written.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, hearing Ryan to talk about it, the song he kind of knew he wanted in, and kind of has that with a lot of songs that sometimes it just doesn't end up working, so he doesn't do it. And this one did end up working, and I think it's great. I think it's a great song, and it works very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it does still kind of strike me as an odd choice, but if it works, then, you know, that's fine. That's all that really needs to be said.
Yeah.
And when we see the mug the first time, as I said, it is funny, and I do think it does that job of placing us between these two time periods, but it's also just a funny joke, you know, to have that mug in that house, so you get a good laugh out of it. And then at least myself, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about that mug, and I didn't think it would be a very meaningful thing in the last like 30 seconds of this movie, and it is. And the bookends are fantastic. I don't see every movie that comes out, but this feels like that's just going to be one of the shots people remember of this year, because it's very meaningful, but it's not, I mean, I guess it is a spoiler in a way, but not, you know, you can just see that image and know a plot point about this movie and kind of feel like you don't have to see it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's this big wide shot that, you know, as you said, he's got the eye makeup, like there is a lot of stuff in it, but, even for someone who hasn't seen the movie, it's just kind of a cool shot. And it's it sums up everything. It's this person who just kept doing the right thing and ended up on the high ground, you know, acted like a good person and ended up in this position for all these people who are terrible to her to be looking after her and to be jealous of her.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that, like you said, it's both meaningful and funny. And that last shot of Marta sipping the coffee, I think really ties into the feeling of this movie that I think makes it so good and so unique. And again, Don Johnson having just been punched in the eye by Jamie Lee Curtis for cheating on her, and that we don't see that violence, but that we see the evidence of that violence in the second, like, I guess third last shot of the movie, is so good. It's like, we're hiding jokes in this movie until the very, very end. And there's a lot of like really short, like brief sort of throwaway jokes throughout this movie that just sort of happen. Like when they're watching the VHS tape and Noah Sagan's character, I forget his name, but the trooper guy, trooper something. He says, oh, it's like a Japanese horror movie off camera. He's like, are we going to die in 7 days? Like there's stuff like that all throughout this movie. And it's great that they sort of did two quiet little jokes tied in the last shots that are meaningful without the comedy. And but that they're still like always like, I want people to be chuckling this whole time. I really love that.
Yeah. And it's the, as you said, kind of the violence between these two characters. We see the aftermath of it. So not only do they not have the house, but obviously their lives are ruined for other reasons. Like now that they know the way that they've been treating each other and that they're bad people, they're not just going to, you get the sense that obviously they're not closer as a result of this experience. You know, like not only did they not get the money that they wanted and were awful people about trying to get, that even just the things that they had, it's not like, oh, well, we still have each other. It's like, yeah, well, no, you don't. You're bad people. You're bad to each other. And so your actions are precluding you from not just having this money, but having what you had before in your personal life. And yeah, I think it's super important to stick a landing with any movie. But I think one like this, where there's kind of something to know, there's this information that you're trying to get. And, you know, you could draw a diagram of what happens when in this movie, and it's, you know, a more interesting diagram than what happens in, I don't know, I haven't even seen it, but A Marriage Story, you know what I mean? Like the anything that's just kind of more character based, that there is so many moving plot points that you really do feel like you're on kind of this journey with this piece of knowable information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's even more important for a movie like that to go out on a strong note, and this one absolutely does that.
Yeah, for sure. So thanks for listening. Check back next time, and we'll be talking about the murder mystery that James doesn't know is hidden within Marriage Story. Thanks for listening.